I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. More than 50 Democratic lawmakers are boycotting Donald Trump's inauguration tomorrow. Some, like Congressman John Lewis, have called him an illegitimate president. Others decided to stay away after Trump tweeted that Lewis, acclaimed civil rights activist, was all talk, talk, talk. Our guest, Congresswoman Bonnie Watson Coleman, who represents New Jersey's 12th district, will not be there. She'll be in Trenton at a vigil at Shiloh Baptist Church. We called her up to find out why. And Congresswoman Coleman, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times. Why are you not attending Donald Trump's inauguration?
Well, I had a thought at the point that he announced one of his first nominees, which was Bannon, to be his senior advisor, that we were moving in the wrong direction. And as he started naming the additional nominees for various positions, particularly cabinet positions, it became quite clear to me that those nominees represented the antithesis of the common good that those positions or those agencies were created for. And I felt that to participate in that inauguration was in some way co-signing onto what this president-elect Donald Trump is doing, and I won't do that. And I'm kind of very sensitive to the fact that from the moment he got elected, my constituents have been blowing up my cell phone, my office phones, my Facebook, my messaging, and everything else, just concerned and scared and very depressed about what they're seeing. And so I thought that it would be better if I were in my district and that we could present an interfaith unity gathering in which we reflect and support and encourage and declare that we're going to stand up and fight for those who will be negatively impacted if we allow these nominees to take their positions and to dismantle those things that represented a democracy and a good and solid government protecting individuals and providing opportunities for those and not creating even more of an underprivileged, disregarded, marginalized citizenry.
What do you say to the millions of voters who believe in their candidate, believed in Donald Trump, and want him to succeed as a president?
Well, first of all, it's not that I don't want the president to succeed. It's important that a president succeeds because that is the leader of our country. To those who supported Donald Trump for that position, I pray that he represents their interests if they are working class people, if they're people who need health care, if they're people whose children are going to public schools and need a public education, if they're in environmental situations that are threatened because we need to be vigilant in enforcing environmental regulations. If it's working class people who need worker protections and decent wages, all of those things, and if there is a need on their part to have the judicial system and the justice system deal with them fairly, then I hope that the person that they supported in the name of Donald Trump meets those needs and obligations on behalf of all the people.
But do you think
so
he will?
Wish any ill will.
But based on your criticism, and you have called him unfit for office, a threat to our democracy, I mean, it sounds as if you and his supporters view this president-elect very differently.
Well, of course we view him differently. We voted differently. If they supported Donald Trump and I supported Hillary Clinton, it is obvious that we have differences in who we thought would best run the country. But I'm an elected member of Congress, and I've been sent down there to ensure that we are passing laws that protect and preserve all of the people, that we're in to ensure that civil rights and human rights are not violated. And if this administration, with Donald Trump at the head of it, does indeed support those initiatives, I'm going to be there with him. But if he doesn't, and if the appointments that he's advanced already try to manifest that which they've represented in their dossiers and in their experience, and that is to dismantle the very essence of the agencies that they're being named to. If they do that, we're going to fight them all the way.
Are you concerned that your boycott could hurt your district?
No, I would not knowingly do anything that would hurt my district. I think whether or not I'm sitting there at the celebration of Donald Trump's presidency will not hurt nor help my district. I think what helps the constituents of my district is for them to know that I am with them and that I recognize that the 12th Congressional District, with all its vast diversity, represents a microcosm of the issues and the concerns and the citizens of this country, and that together we will stand strong, they will have the representation that they deserve, and that we will do that which is best on behalf of all citizens.
I know you're
not just enriching the very wealthy.
I know you'll be at a vigil tomorrow in Trenton. Are you going to participate in any of the marches on Saturday?
Oh, absolutely. I am doing the march in New Jersey because I think it's important for me to stay close to my constituents.
Well, I want to thank you for getting our conversation started. Bonnie Watson-Coleman, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me. Have a good day.
You too. And she's Congresswoman representing New Jersey's 12th Congressional District. While some members of Congress, like Bonnie Watson-Coleman, are boycotting Donald Trump's inauguration tomorrow, hundreds of thousands of supporters will be attending. And on Saturday, the Women's March on Washington promises to bring several hundred thousand protesters to the city for a rally. Their message is aimed at all levels of government to protect the rights of women, their families, and their communities. That's from their press release. There are similar events in cities across the country on Saturday, including here in Philadelphia. Washington, as we all know, has been a site of many demonstrations. I was there for anti-war protests back in the 1960s. Let me introduce our two guests. Our guest, Todd Gitlin, was a political activist in the 1960s. In fact, he was president of SDS, Students for a Democratic Society, was an organizer of the first anti-war demonstration back in 1965. Today, he's chairman of the PhD program in communications at Columbia University, also a professor of journalism and sociology. And Todd Gitlin, it's been a couple of years. Nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Nice to be here.
Also with us is Thomas Wrighton. He's a professor of strategic communication at Temple University, where he teaches a course called Contemporary American Social Movements. And Thomas Wright, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you for having me.
Todd, let me go back to you only because you've got this long history with demonstrations and probably boycotts as well. Is it unusual to see so many members of Congress staying away from Donald Trump's inauguration on Friday?
Oh, so far as I know, it's unique. The mission of everybody plays nice. We play a consensus game traditionally on Inauguration Day. So there's a chorus of approval of the process of peaceful transition, if not enthusiasm about the incomer.
Well, it's interesting, as President Obama's talked about this peaceful process that we have had over these 200-plus years. To you, Todd Gitlin, I mean, it's interesting to hear the president. Obviously, he will be there. But to know that, you know, 50, almost 60 members of Congress are not going to be there. I don't think those will be empty chairs necessarily, but it seems like it's sending a powerful message.
Yeah, I think it's a sign of the seriousness that many people feel about resisting what there are many good reasons to think are an illegitimate presidency. By the way, I think it would have been entirely coherent for Democrats to have stayed home on the day that George W. Bush was inaugurated after having been installed as president by the Supreme Court, but never mind.
Well, interesting you say that, because apparently John Lewis did boycott that election because he also saw that as illegitimate based on, I guess, the ruling of the U.S. Supreme Court.
Well, good for him. And I wasn't aware of that. And I guess if he had any co-conspirators, they didn't get a lot of publicity because I missed it.
Well, let me turn to you, Thomas, and I do want to talk more deeply about demonstrations and protests. What do you think of this boycott? I'm curious.
It's interesting to see how it's going to turn out in the long run, because what we see in a lot of social movements and protests is that If they're not connecting to institutional power structures or people who are in power, they won't have a long-term impact. So while it's a symbolic, obviously important symbolically for those members not to attend, it seems it's just as important for political activists to connect with those congresspersons and use them as a way to make important social changes.
So symbolism is nice.
Symbolism is always
nice. And perhaps
nice.
Gets a lot of attention and coverage, but you're saying that by itself is not particularly powerful message.
It's a powerful message, but it needs to be connected to long-term social activism. This is something that we talk about a lot in class with my students. You have to understand that a lot of students don't have a deep understanding of social movements or social protests in the United States. So I spend part of my time educating them about the long history of social protests in the United States. I often tell them we now live in an activist culture where we have continuous political and social activism and social movements and protests. Part of the downside of that is that some of it gets lost because there are so many. Back to my point, though, it's important for the symbolism, but if we look at social movements in American history, their effectiveness is always tied to some sort of power structure enacting those particular changes. You can't have changes if you don't have institutions to go along with those.
I want to pick up on that, but let me go back to you, Todd Gitlin, talking about having the long game, thinking about all the protests against the Vietnam War, of which you were among one of the leaders. Do you agree with that?
Well, I want to say I completely agree with what Thomas just said. I agree in boldface and in spades. I think that I would put it a little differently. Protest matters, and it matters most when it translates into taking power seriously. So I would say the goal is not to enter into a relation with the power structure. The goal is to win power. And I think one of the advantages that the right has had for a long time is that they take power seriously. They're not ambivalent about it. They like hierarchies. They approve of discipline. They get things done. So over the recent years, with the help of a subservient media with a lot of money, the Tea Party became began as a fringe phenomenon. But it very quickly became a key component of the Republican Party. It skewed the political discourse in its direction, and it culminated in what we're now beholding. And I think that there is a very poor understanding in many quarters on the left, especially among newer activists, about how the government works. The president doesn't wave a wand. Decisions that affect national policy are made locally and by states, thus voting rights infringements, thus redistricting. Republicans now control 32 out of the 50 states.
You know what, Todd? Hold on to that thought. I do want to pick up on it after this very short break. And you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow, and we're talking about protests, what make them effective. And we want to hear from you if you're going to any of the protests over the next couple of days or the inauguration. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. I'm talking with Thomas Wright. He's a professor of strategic communication at Temple University, and Todd Gitlin, professor of journalism and sociology, also chair of the PhD program in communications at Columbia University. Todd, let me pick up on something that you said about really comparing the left and the right when it comes to protests, that the Tea Party seemed to understand power better than, let's say, Occupy Wall Street. What don't liberals, what don't Democrats understand?
Well, it's not just a matter of intellectual understanding. I think it's a matter of culture. The culture of the left, at least in the United States, is was strongly affected. It's averse to verticality. It likes horizontality. It doesn't want to follow orders. It wants everybody to participate. It wants, and there are obviously exceptions, but roughly speaking, The activists of the right are authoritarian, and the activists of the left are loosey-goosey.
Well said. You know, we've got a little, I'm not sure if we need to fix your phone or not, but let me get, Thomas, let me get you back in on the conversation. You were nodding your head vigorously as Todd was talking about the sort of difference between left activism and right activism.
Yeah, I could not agree more. I think one of the important ideas or lessons that's always lost on partially on the left and other social activists is the importance of organization. And that is not just top-down but both horizontal also. One of the examples I always use is because everybody is familiar with the civil rights movement. Like every student that comes to class knows the civil rights movement. But their understanding of it is one in which Martin Luther King gave a great speech and then the civil rights movement happened and then it was over. And what I teach them is that – and I was just this week watching I Have a Dream speech with my own children.
Yeah.
And I was trying to impart to them this idea that – The hidden talent, hidden by me and we forgot about it, is that Martin Luther King was a great organizer, that he was very adept at using the mechanisms of the church, of understanding the mechanisms of power in Washington, how to apply pressure to those particular pressure points of institutional powers in Washington to get things done. And that lesson of organization became partially the idea of professionalization in the 70s and 80s, but somehow it got lost during the anti-war movements of the early 90s and the early aughts. And I think as Professor Gitlin points out rightly, for all of the amazing things that took place in the Occupy movement and how many people for a very brief period of time were connected to it and knew about it and what a great impact it had for a very short period of time, that decentralized horizontal power structure and other factors sort of played into it was in a way like a death knell for it. Like it really strangled that particular movement from growing.
And did – I mean Tea Party was able to elect – numbers of members of Congress. They've had, as Todd Gitlin was saying, had a pretty strong influence there. And Todd, let me go back to you. You wrote a piece, an interesting piece about Americans for Prosperity. This is an organization funded largely by the Koch brothers and with lots of money. And I'm thinking about Occupy Wall Street up against Americans for Prosperity. And literally, as Joe Biden says, literally what you can do with money when it comes to trying to influence politics. And of course, there's ALEC, which helped and numbers of legislatures across the country to write legislation. Can you speak to that?
Yeah, very important. Occupy Wall Street disdained power, considered politicians dirty. John Lewis was actually denied the ability to speak at a rally of Occupy Atlanta because there was an objection to him as an exalted person being recognized above the regulars. And this is a very old story. Just to supplement the point about organization, which again is, you know, we're going to have a mutual admiration society because what Thomas said is so important. So we just went through the Martin Luther King weekend, and I think not only did people not understand that King was an organizer, they think of him simply as a mobilizer, but they don't understand there were institutions at work. So here's a story. True story. In the 50s and 60s, there was a billboard that appeared all over the American South. It was put up by the crackpot right John Birch Society. It showed a picture of Martin Luther King and a group of people and an arrow pointing him, and it said King. And the headline was Martin Luther King at Communist Training School. Now, that was not a communist training school. It was the Highlander Folk Center, which was a wonderful institution established by a one-time organizer named Miles Horton to help train people in citizenship classes and in organizing. This was where Rosa Parks went to learn how to do what she did in Montgomery. That was an institution. There was yesterday an obit in the New York Times of a man named Wesley Dunbar, who was a white Southerner who was connected with something called the Voter Education Project. This was an institution that, while the civil rights movement was putting on events that would become – that would be telegenic, like Birmingham, which King was very deliberate about. It was part of the stagecraft of the civil rights movement. The Voter Education Project and others like that were actually training people in how to get registered to vote, how to get over the hurdles that were put up by the white supremacists and so on. So we don't, you know, a lot of everybody talks now about the importance of organizing, but I don't think that people have grasped that organizing means creating and sustaining organizations. And organizations are not just one day show ups.
Well, and more nodding going on down here in Philadelphia, but I think it's such an important point. The question, I guess, Tom, and to you, Todd, as well, is just what creates that kind of staying power? And is it, and I'm looking at you, Tom, is it that if you don't really believe in political power, if you don't really like Congress, you don't like the sausage making of legislation, then you're going to disdain that particular institution. But do you lose if you've got that perspective?
That's a difficult question for me to answer because, again, my perspective is trying to teach young people about the power of organizing and all of the resources that are available to them. There are many organizations out there that will help train and teach and show people how to create organizational structure. I mean, one of the most difficult things is how do you make people impassioned?
Yeah.
You know, the historical approach was to say that there were, again, these great speeches, that there were these, you know, great slogans, that people were, empowered by these usually great men in society. But as I've studied social movements more, I have moved more towards an understanding of the power of organizational structure across time, resource development. Again, while we might frame it differently, connections to different power structures to allow you to affect change. One of the unsung aspects of social movements is the personal connections that people form with other people. And you can't tell someone, be a friend, right? But on the other hand, if you look at the research on social movements, it's very clear that personal connections to people are what help create long-term relationships that help sustain those movements across time. To try and get at that, you've seen some people move towards using very traditional, almost like corporate development building, like culture building tools. That's pretty nascent, but like culture development tools, people don't like to feel like they're being forced into relationships, but you need a way to break down the boundary of just disliking Donald Trump is not going to be enough.
You have to like the people that you're
perhaps disliking him with. Absolutely.
Todd, let me go back to you. And you mentioned this billboard with Martin Luther King on it, basically accusing him of being a communist. We've also got – there's the internet, of course, which is filled with the sort of digital versions of that, a video released by James O'Keefe, Project Veritas. This came up yesterday on the show, and I have to say I completely dropped the ball on it because I didn't know that there was this – ridiculous claim that organizers were being paid to put acid in some of the air conditioning units or heating units to try to discredit and destroy, in a sense, the Trump inauguration. There's a lot of that floating around as well, Todd. Is that anything new?
Well, of course, it spreads much, much easier. Fraud now travels at the speed of light, and it diffuses sometimes out of the very Twitter feed of the president-elect. This is a hurdle. And but actually, I think in the uproar about fake news, I mean, I share my alarm and distress, but I think we're losing sight of something in the emphasis on fake news. Fake news has been cranked out by the right-wing echo chamber, what I call the vortex, the voices of right-wing extremism, for decades now. Before the internet, talk radio, Limbaugh, Hannity and company, Fox News, obviously, and now the new means, they have falsified the nature of the world. So that, for example, I'm not only thinking about little fake scandals like the birther movement and the 9/11 truthers, but I'm thinking about the belief, for example, widespread that Social Security is in crisis, that the deficit is about to explode. That has crippled American politics for decades now. And propaganda outfits have a variety of means of disinformation and falsification. And it is alarming that this stuff spreads like wildfire.
Yeah, and people believe.
A lot of people apparently don't seem to know. I mean, there was a study out of Stanford recently that suggested that lots and lots of people, including college students, don't know the difference between fabrication and news. And, this is alarming.
Well, I think it goes even beyond college students, based on the conversation I had yesterday. Let me get Zach from Doylestown to join our conversation. And, Zach, go ahead. You're on Radio Times. Go ahead, Zach.
Hello. Nice to be talking with you all.
Go ahead.
I'd like to comment about the use of language in politics. The right wing has been very good at creating a list of buzzwords to drive the conversation. Entitlements. Referencing global warming, to try and deflect from the complexities of climate change. They say, it's warm outside or it's cold right now. It's winter. The globe can't be warming. And this is part of the way they've falsified the world and the narrative. And so I'd like to know what ways we can better use language on the left, because the right seems to dominate the conversation, even if people don't necessarily agree. Now we're talking about entitlements. We're not actually talking about the reality of transfer payments and are they good or bad. So I'd like to get your comments on that.
It's a good question or good comment, Zach. And Tom, let me put that to you about how we use language. I mean, there are certain buzz phrases that just seem to resonate for whatever reason. And I don't know whether conservatives have a better handle on how to do that than liberals.
Well, simplifying ideas and having easy slogans, is one of the tried and true methods of communicating ideas to people. The challenge, as the caller, Zach, right, obviously notes, is that rational thinking and thought, that sort of central processing, is very challenging. It takes literally more time and effort to pay attention to data, to look at hard statistics, to pour through the news, to read challenging articles than it is to have slogans. I don't believe that there is a simple solution to having a perfect replacement language on the left, because as Professor Gitlin's pointed out, the approaches are very different in the way they look at the world sometimes. If you want to simplify things, if you want a simplistic worldview, if you want one it's easy to digest and communicate, then you can come up with slogans and simplify words and make those things happen. On the other hand, if you want to be an engaged, thoughtful, rational person who wants to take the look of the world as a complicated place with many moving variables and factors, it's not easy to sort of you just approach the world in very different ways.
A hard message to sell. Let me read a comment from Ron. Says, I've been to a few protests. It seems like some of them today don't involve sacrifice beyond time. Is this the case? Don't they run the risk of simply being rallies high on emotion and low on action? Todd, do you share Ron's concern?
Well, I think emotion is an indispensable element in politics. I mean, people feel their way through the world. They don't just reason their way through the world. And as much as we want to raise the profile of reason, we need to recognize how people move and what they respond to. So I think politics is not a place of purity. Look, if you're looking for purity, stay home in your cubicle. Don't go out on the street. Don't get involved in politics. It's full of ambiguous people with mixed motives, and some of them are a pain to work with, and people make errors, and sometimes they lie. And there you are. That's the human material we're dealing with. I think it's fine to try to find more encompassing slogans. And I'll give you an example of some place where our side, if you will, fell down badly this year. Trump, obviously had a one-liner, which frankly to me, and like a lot of other people initially, just seemed ridiculous. Make America great again. What did that mean? And so on and so on. You could go on around about it. But you had no trouble as whether you were a hardcore Trump supporter or not, sort of knowing, quote-unquote, what he stood for. And by the way, it wasn't any any vaguer than yes, we can. Which was, you know, whatever. I mean, you could unpack that in many, many
sure,
ways.
Sure, Obama's not a political tagline.
Program.
Yep.
Right. So now it's if you looked on the Trump or Republican websites during the campaign, you found such slogans, simple bullet points, jobs, no trade, bad immigrants. But finally, all collected under this rubric, Make America Great Again. If you looked at Hillary or Democrats, you found a list of programs. You didn't find an overarching theme. There's no theme in this pudding, to use that phrase. I mean, why wasn't she saying Make America Fair? Why aren't we saying that now? I mean, I think we do need a common program when we take to organizing locally, which has to be done. And I have no objection to bumper stickerizing a component of it.
Because it sounds like because it works from your perspective. Tom, we're almost up on a break, but I know you want to add something.
Yeah, I mean, one excellent example in the last few years is Black Lives Matter. I mean, it's a very simple, straightforward statement that is effective. I mean, people have disagreed, obviously, about the purpose of the movement. People have argued about the impact of the movement, the effectiveness of it, about what lives matter, inserting other, you know, modifiers in front of lives matter to sort of attack the movement. But I think the simplest statement of Black Lives Matter was very effective. I think students certainly responded to it. I think it resonated enough. If your opponents are attacking it and coming up with counter statements, then it seems to be pretty effective.
Well, that's interesting. And that's Tom Wright. He's a professor of strategic communication at Temple University. Also with us, Todd Gitlin, a professor of journalism and sociology and chair of the PhD program in communications at Columbia University. We are talking about talking and protests and communication. A lot of people want to join the conversation, 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane, talking with Todd Gitlin and Thomas Wright about what makes for an effective protest. And we're curious about whether you'll be attending any of the protests in the next couple of days or perhaps even the Donald Trump inauguration. We want to hear from you. And again, that phone number, 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. An email from Paul. He says, you can hardly get these protesters to vote. They get bored and the protesting will quickly disappear. The 60s was a culture of drugs, sex, etc. Less distractions. Although as a child of the 60s, there were a lot of distractions back then, Todd. But do you think this younger generation that they're apathetic about politics or about engagement, Todd? And I'll put that to you, Tom, as well.
I mean, the answer is clearly yes. Most Americans don't vote, and millennials notoriously show up for presidential elections, at least when Barack Obama's on the ballot, but did not show up in the midterms, which explains very economically why the Democrats collapsed in 2010 and 2014 in Congress with consequences that are still going to play out. I do think the caller is right in general. I think there's something of an oversimplification about, you know, drug, sex, rock and roll being the only story operating in the 60s. I mean, you know, while people were doing drug, sex, and rock and roll, they were also working for candidates. But there was an assumption at that time that, the country was against us, so we might as well sort of cut loose. And I think what everybody needs to understand is how closely this country is divided. One of the things one does as a citizenly obligation is vote. You do boring things. You get up in the morning, you brush your teeth. It's, you know, social health. Voting is part of social health. Getting people to turn out is part of social health. And if students don't understand it, or young people in general don't understand it, they're misinformed and they need to be educated.
You're saying it's the Brussels sprouts, the broccoli of life as opposed to the dessert?
Well, it's not that. I mean, personally, I love Brussels sprouts. You know, different veg for different folks.
I got you.
Life is not just a fun fest, folks.
I do want to get some callers in, and Tom, looks like you want to add something.
This is a mutual admiration society because I, too, love Brussels sprouts.
Oh, do you? I'm working on it. But, yeah, go ahead.
I think that this is just my experience. I'm based on my own anecdotal experience that they're very politically aware. I think they have a good understanding of the political system. They have a good understanding of a lot of the topics that are covered. But I think to be sympathetic, we have to understand they've grown up in a world in which you've had essentially two warring factions which have done everything they possibly can to undermine each other at every turn. While we may have different views about the concept of fake news, they've grown up in a world which has had seen this promulgated. It's more prevalent. It's in their digital lives all the time. And so I'm sympathetic, disturbed sometimes, but sympathetic to their cynicism about the political process, that if they see one in which it's always a one-upmanship, always in attack mode where you can't work with anybody, if they grew up with 8 years of President Obama and they've seen continuously nothing but one side saying he's a false president, he wasn't born here, and the other side saying that's ridiculous, and then attacking each other. I'm impressed that so much got done, honestly, while people attack President Obama for not getting enough done.
Let me get Dan from looks like Winmore to join our conversation. Hi, Dan. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty. You've already mentioned ALEC, but in the last 40 or more than 40 years, conservatives have formed other think tanks that have turned out white papers and policy for the conservatives, such as Cato Institute, even American Enterprise Institute and the Heritage Foundation. I think Jim DeMint left Congress because he saw he could be more powerful running the Heritage Foundation than being in Congress. So I'm wondering, get a comment from your guests, what's the power and effect of those types of think tanks and policy-forming organizations up to now, and are they still relevant in light of social media, fake news, outside propaganda?
Big question. Todd, you want to take that?
Yeah, I think they are relevant. I think there was an attempt on the left, roughly speaking, to play catch-up after having lost the 70s and 80s. So we had the emergence of outfits like the Center for American Progress and the Economic Policy Institute, and they do fine. I mean, they work out policies and they try to promote them. I think the central difference, though, is that there's a whole lot more money behind the right-wing enterprises. There's a kind of esprit de corps that they've become used to. I mean, they've been running policy for decades now. They wrote policy for Reagan. They're still writing policy. They and the companies that finance them were writing official statements for Mr. Pruitt, the putative EPA nominee, when he was Attorney General in Oklahoma. We need more of it, but again, I would say, you know, while we need policy ideas, I don't think there's any real shortage. I mean, sort of, if you were an educated person looking for policy initiatives, you'd have no trouble finding them. The problem is that they don't have the political purchase. There is no equivalent of the Tea Party that says, well, we know that the government is poisonous and ruinous and that deregulation is necessary and so on, and here are 50 variants of that that are prepackaged for use in your local campaigns. I don't think the left is organized that way.
Tom, I wonder whether, I guess, a test of an effective protest is what happens on the day after that protest. I mean, everyone mobilizes and organizes and gets buses, and they go to whatever protests they're going to go to. And then the question is, and then what?
Yeah, and this might relate back to that we were just talking about, the idea of cynicism and impact. This is the beauty and the complexity and the problem of contemporary political culture, is this: the continuous political culture of protest is one in which there's always a protest going on somewhere. It's very easy to teach my class in some ways because every day I can find a new protest across the United States. Every day I can find a new group that is formed that wants to have an impact. And a lot of those do locally, statewide, and nationally. It's very challenging because it's just an immensity, such a large quantity of different protests are taking place all the time. When you talk about the impact and the next day, well, the next day, it's like everything else contemporary culture. There's another one that sort of takes its place. Yeah. And unless you are personally involved in that particular topic, and you're following it, it is, again, like everything else, you can very easily just scroll down your Twitter feed to another protest that's taken place.
May I make a proposal?
Sure. Go ahead, Tom.
In the spirit of what you're saying, I think in every campus there ought to be a group, it could be three people, who set up tables the next day saying, and after protest, ? And there needs to be a website everywhere which is directed to after the protest. And it says basically, if you understand that we need long-term, enduring, disciplined work to move this thing, we want you. We will find you a place to work. Sign up here. We're going to start meeting. If you had, you know, a dozen people in a zip code or on a campus who were committed to going to work, certainly Pennsylvania is ripe territory. Don't we all understand that now and how important Pennsylvania is electorally? If, you know, 5 people, 10 people on a campus would make big things happen if they were serious and unflappable.
Let me read a couple of comments and we'll get some more callers in. An email from Muriel. She says, offering peaceful transition to the man who refused to concede if he did not win the election is hypocrisy. He has gamed the system and won. I would not criticize any elected official who refused to attend in support of their constituents. An email from Hillary. Ever since the advent of social media, there has been a lot of name calling on both sides. It's hard to take someone seriously or have a mature discussion when it ends in name calling. And she goes on from there. Let me get Mary from, looks like Lansdale, to join our conversation. Hi, Mary. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes. Hi. I'm a Democratic committee person in Upper Gwynedd, so Lansdale is just the zip code. But up here, we've got an unusual situation because Montgomery County recently went like 50% Democratic registration, 50% Republican, and that's the case in my little division right here. The problem for us is we live in the second most gerrymandered district in the country for U.S. congressional office. And so our congressman would not listen to us because he knows his job is safe. Even if he did listen to us, he would be primaried by the Tea Party for being a rhino. And so there's extremely little we can do, even though we have the vote. So we are organized, and I want to let everybody know that we are organized as a Democratic Party. But it's very frustrating. The only thing to do would be to take over the state house, which in Pennsylvania is probably unlikely.
Well, you raise a couple of really good points, Mary. I appreciate the call to Radio Times. And Todd, I hear you going, go ahead.
Yeah. Well, I mean, good for you for trying. I mean, I don't know the ins and outs. Pennsylvania is one of the worst gerrymanders of states.
It is.
In 2012, as I bet most of your listeners know, I think while the Democrats won a majority of the votes, the Republicans ended up with, I think, 13 out of 21 members of Congress. I mean, that's a scandal. There may be legal recourses that are possible. Maybe it's impossible to take over the state house. That I don't know. Trying to do it is crucial. Being insistent about the voter suppression that takes place, either through the direct legislation about who's qualified to vote or through gerrymandering, is crucial. Keep it up. It needs to be a central pivot of a program of reconstruction.
Mary, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Let me toss this to both of you. I'll start with you, Tom. I wonder, though, whether movements need either a martyr, and I'm thinking of Martin Luther King, or a villain. And there are plenty of people I could put on that list. In my day, it was Richard Nixon. But I wonder whether you need something like that in order to either organize people or even make progress.
That is very interesting. I was just reading an article the other day about this. I don't know about a martyr. Certainly villains are important because they do bring focus. But some of the most current research on this, while it's important to have that villain, that movements that focus solely on an individual person as the boogeyman or boogey person – in the long term, often don't have as much policy or political impact. And the example used in the article I was reading was the anti-war movement, the war in Iraq, and that its focus on George Bush by making him, you know, if you go through the literature and look at him portrayed as a Nazi or Stalin or an evildoer, that by continuously focusing on him as the, you know, the moving force behind it, that it didn't actually lead to much policy change in the long term. And so I've been thinking about that a lot lately about dealing with President-elect Trump, is that by turning him into that, by using the language of the tyrant, of the Nazi, of the dictator, while we might use a Venn diagram and find some overlap with those things, that in the long run, unless there's specific policy-oriented changes that those groups want, it's not probably not going to be as successful.
What do you think, Todd?
Well, it's the Republican Party, folks. I mean, they nominated this guy, and they have been obscurantist, deceptive, and dangerous for decades. So, yeah, you know, look at the crowd around Trump, and there's no shortage of adversaries. About martyrs, you know, long before Martin Luther King was killed, civil rights workers and people just trying to register to vote were being knocked off in the South. I remember well finding out about these people. You know, there are people are being victimized all the time. All those people who showed up at the congressional meeting in Colorado the other day to meet their congressman, only 10, because there were so many of them, he took fright and fled. And they were some of these people were interviewed on local news saying, you know, I have cancer. What am I going to do? And so on. There's no shortage of people whose suffering can be directly tied to the policies of the Republican Party, which, by the way, are in general, once they're pinned down, quite unpopular. You know, we're a very poorly informed country. People who thought, you know, they could keep the Affordable Care Act, but get rid of Obamacare. Okay, there you are. It's like, get the government hands off my Social Security. There's tremendous ignorance about how things actually work. So, you know, we need clarity about those issues. And so I don't think that there's any shortage of either martyrs or adversaries.
But we're almost about on the end of the show here. But as you describe the Republican Party, but also extremely successful.
Up to this point, extremely successful because, you know, at the risk of repeating myself, they were ruthless. They were disciplined. They knew what they wanted. They were well-funded. They had media channels. And they believed in winning.
You think the Democrats can do that? Or is there something sort of psychologically incapable of doing that?
What I hope for is the development of a progressive caucus which knows all those things and is dead serious about becoming the Democratic Party through local work over time.
We're going to end on that note. Todd Gitlin, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
A pleasure.
And he's chair of the PhD program in communications at Columbia University, where he's a professor of journalism and sociology and was a political activist back in the 1960s. Thomas Wright, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. Professor of strategic communication at Temple University here in Philadelphia, teaches a course each semester called Contemporary American Social Movements. Go to WHYY.org/radiotimes and you can find out much more about this program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter. I'm Marty Moscoing. Thanks for joining us.